Well, good morning or good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you're dialing from. Thanks for joining. My name is Fern Marie Brady. I am a program manager in the Link SRS team, and I am absolutely delighted to be here co-hosting this developer roundtable because it is the very first time that we're publicly deep diving into Link's Unified Communications Web API. My partner in crime today is Alex Edelsberg, and he's going to introduce himself. Alex.
Hi everyone. Thanks for the intro, Fern Marie. My name is Alex Edelsberg, as you just said, program manager on the Link server platform team. Like Fern Marie said, we're here to do our first public deep dive of our newly released Unified Communications Web API.
Thanks, Alex. So with us also, we have James Jones, who is a developer for Sociable Now. And James is here because he built an application with this API. And I wanted to showcase that app just to give you guys an idea of what people are building with the web API. So for the benefit of those of you who are joining for the first time, I want to take a second to put this session into its proper context, because although it is the very first time that we're deep diving, back before the API was public, back in August 14th, Alex gave us a general overview of the API. He walked through some samples, and that session is available. If you want to go check it out, go to channel9.msdn.com and type in the word UCWA in the search, and you will be able to access that recording. So today, I'm going to give you a little bit of background, walk through the website that we've built for this API, then we're going to go over documentation, getting started, some libraries, demos, and we're going to have time for Q&A. So let's get started. If you've been following Link's 2013 product release, then by now you have probably experienced the tremendous functionality that comes out of the box with Link 2013. And most of you also know that in addition of the out-of-the-box functionality, we also provide you guys with a developer platform. And the reason Alex and I are here today is because as of 2 weeks ago, our developer platform got even better with the Unified Communications Web API. And perhaps you've actually ever have already seen it if you were part of the Link Developer Tab this past year, or perhaps if you attended the Link conference a few weeks ago, then you got to see firsthand demos that were showcasing seamless communications integrating across multiple platforms and devices. Or perhaps you jumped into your marketplace or app store of choice and you already downloaded the Link mobile app. So what a lot of people don't realize is that all of those Link mobile apps are actually powered by the Unified Communications Web API. So we at Microsoft believe that this technology is a giant leap forward, and we want to empower you guys to use that API. That's why we make part of that API publicly available, because we at Microsoft recognize that you guys have the power to transform communications and connect people in ways that we've never seen before. You know your verticals, you know your markets really well, and you know what problems are out there, and you know how to solve them. So we're making this API available to you to empower you to connect people in new and different ways. And the reason why I'm so sure that you guys are doing this is because we've already seen it happen. This past year, we had the largest developer tab in the history of our product. We have seen companies from all around the world leveraging the developer platform to create groundbreaking applications that are spanning every vertical and market, ranging from healthcare to finance, education, manufacturing, public sector, hospitality, and the list will go on and on and on. And these apps are built with our developer platform. Some of them are with the managed API, which is the APIs we had there historically. But a lot of them are actually built with the Unified Communications Web API. And in the end of this discussion, we'll show you some of those apps. All right, so if you're wondering, okay, so what's new? Well, guys, absolutely everything about UCWA is new. So from the design principles of the API to the documentation strategy to the website that hosts it, Everything was purposefully designed to service what we call this rising community of web and mobile developers. So here are some of the innovations that we've put in place. So first thing, we're complementing the Link Developer Center on MSDN by specifically targeting mobile and web. We created this interactive demo that I'm very proud of because what we do is we showcase the power of the API in real time as we also teach developers to replicate that functionality live. And you'll get to see that in a second because I'm going to demo that next. We also put together a developer sandbox to remove the friction of having to have your own link topology in your environment in order to start coding. With our API, we're providing you a developer sandbox so that you can get started from the web without the need of having your own environment set up. We also have innovations around documentation, and Alex is going to talk to us about those. But without further ado, let us get to the demo. So here's the URL. If you go to any browser and you type in ucwa.link.com, you will see this homepage. And we have several innovations that we're going to, between Alex and I, we're going to go through most of those today. But to start out with, this is what I was referring to, that we're complementing the Link Developer Center on MSDN by providing you this website right from the bat. So right now, I'm going to go through the interactive demo. So I have already signed in via my Microsoft account, and that's why you didn't have to log in or authenticate. But if you're going for the first time, you're going to have to authenticate in order to go through this demo. So the first thing that we do is we introduce the concept of having three test accounts. So these are three accounts that you're going to use throughout the demo, and once you exit the demo, you're going to use authentication tokens from these test accounts to go into that developer sandbox that I mentioned a little bit ago. So, in terms of the API functionality, here we have change presence and or status note. So if you're a developer coming here for the first time, maybe you would say, hello world. And what would happen is that we're showcasing the power of the API, and we're doing this live, real time. We're also teaching developers how to replicate that functionality. So, and this is live, so if I were to say, do not disturb, then you can see here that Amy's availability has been changed to do not disturb. So we're using code snippets with curl. The next piece that we're using, the next piece that we're showcasing is how to subscribe to the presence of others. So here we have Fernando's client, and Fernando has two buddies. Amy is one of them. So if Amy changes her status to be right back, what we're doing is showing developers how to do this themselves. And also, this is actually talking to a Link server. So here you can see from the browser how Fernando was able to subscribe to Amy's presence, and that's how being set here to be right back from his client. So again, this is all performed live with curl. And curl, by the way, is a cross-platform web request tool, and it's language agnostic. So that's the reason we chose it. So we could have, for example, used JavaScript, but what if the developer really wanted to create an iPhone app and his language of choice is Objective-C? So we didn't want to tie to any specific language, and that's why we chose curl. The next piece is how to send an IM. We can say, hey, want to go to lunch? To Sarah. And Sarah could say, no way. And we're showing that functionality in curl. The next piece is how to use the call via work feature would allow a developer to call someone else via PSTN. And instead of going through this right now, in the interest of time, what I'm going to do is encourage you to go to any browser and type in ucwa.link.com/explore and check out the functionality yourself. It's pretty cool. But right now, what I want to do is now have Alex show you guys what will happen once you go through this demo and you have those three test accounts, how to then get started with the developer sandbox. So Alex?
Can everyone hear me? Those sound like yeses. Also, they're coming after I ask, which means it's probably working. All right, so I'm going to jump back in right where Fernmarie left off. And for those of you who saw our previous video, that demo, some pieces of it may look familiar, kind of like the functionality in the samples we showed off last time. That's just a much more polished and well-put-together, slick demo using the same exact functionality and helper libraries that the samples themselves use. So like Fernmarie said, when you're done with the interactive demo, it drops you off here. And it talks about downloading and extracting the samples and setting them up. Real quick, before I do that, I want to take a slight detour and talk about how or some of the principles in UCWA that are important to know before we actually do a deeper dive. So let me switch back to the PowerPoint. All right, so the first thing that we want to talk about is what the API is. Well, we have these downloadable helper libraries for you to use. They are just that. They're helper libraries. They're not actually the API. We did our best effort to make sure that they work, and if you run into issues with them, we are curious to hear about them. But the API, as we've delivered it to you, is what's happening on the wire. So what this diagram shows is your app talking to the server, and those two arrows, those two lines joining them, they represent the API. We've called out two pieces here, the command channel and the event channel. So the command channel allows you to make requests to the server and receive responses. This is synchronous. This is very standard for HTTP. Your browser's doing this all the time. When Fernmarie hit ucwa.link.com, her browser did a GET request and it pulled down the HTML for the page. Or in UCWA, you would do a GET on the presence resource and we would send you back your presence. The event channel is an asynchronous method for the server to notify your app. So if you wanted to get someone's presence without having to pull for it, there's a way to set up events that we would send down whenever presence changes, so you wouldn't have to pull. These two and the data that flow across them represent the API. So a couple more pieces. Oh, and as it says up there, there are four HTTP verbs that we make use of here in this API. If you're familiar with HTTP 1.1 RFC, which... we got quite familiar with while designing the API. There's many more verbs than this, but we've chosen to limit the scope, and they kind of map to the acronym CRUD, create, read, update, and delete. So resources, which exist on the server, represent our objects, if you're more in the object-oriented land than in the REST-oriented land. These live on the server, and they have a set of properties and links to related resources. I'll get into that in a minute. An app will make CRUD requests on these, and the server may optionally send updates about resources on the event channel. And like I said about those helpers, which is what we're about to dive into, there are a set of helpers that take care of boilerplate that pretty much every app developer would have to deal with in the first place. For example, we have one that helps you with event channel management, since it's something that most apps will want to make use of. So the other thing I was going to discuss was the resources in a bit more detail. And you can see here this is an example resource in JSON, and we'll be favoring JSON a whole lot today because it's much easier for us to handle JSON in JavaScript in the browser than it would be XML, although we do support XML as well. And so you can see there are three parts called out. Up at the top, we have the web link collection. So these are links to other resources that may be related in some way. Underneath that, we have a collection of embedded resources. These are like links, except we think that the resources are so often used together that we saved you having to do a round trip. Like we said, this is mobile. This API was designed with mobile in mind, so you can imagine that for the sake of your battery life, not having to always do multiple gets for resources that are often used in tandem is a nice way to save battery. And finally, for the resource itself, you have a set of properties. And actually, these embedded in links are optional. There's almost always a self-link to a resource. And there's often, they're embedded is optional depending on whether or not we think that it's necessary for that resource. And the important thing to call about these links and embedded resources is they represent a concept called hypermedia. It makes sense if you think about it from a more standard web browser perspective, if you go to CNN.com, we have links to multiple articles. And if you look at the A tag on the web page, you got the href, which is the programmatic reference to where the browser should go. And then between the open and closing A tag, you have some text for the human. The way that we format this in JSON, you can see that we have a link there called policies. And then inside of the curly braces, we would have an href and a link to where it's going, just like the href and an A tag. And the idea of using hypermedia in our API is unique because instead of having to craft your own links, which is often quite error-prone, you only use the links that the API provides to you. And so with that quick little detour, I'm going to jump back into the samples. So let me share my screen again. By the way, if you guys didn't see what Kaya just typed, please feel free to start typing questions. Now we'll collect them and have Q&A at the end. So I'm going to follow these steps with you guys and show you how quick this is. So the first thing is to go ahead and download the helper libraries. So I'm going to click Go, we're going to download, and it's already done. So you see we have the USEWA February 2013 samples. I'm going to go ahead and extract them. And just for the sake of typing, I'm going to rename this folder to Demo. Now, the next thing it says to do is to configure a web server such as IIS on your local machine to serve the files. So if you want to set up IIS and you don't have it and you're kind of following along in Windows 8, it's as simple as hitting the Windows key, typing in components, going to settings, and doing turn Windows features on or off. Once the dialog loads, we'll see IIS is here. If you don't have it installed, you won't have anything checked. If you check it, you'll get this partial checkbox like I have. The defaults are good enough for USEWA. We really don't need that much to run these samples. You would click it so it's partially checked, click OK, and after about a minute or so it gets installed. I don't even think you need to restart. For the sake of time, I've already done it, and I figure we all don't need to watch a loading dialog box, so I save this a step. So we've got this demo file, and we've got IIS installed, and now it says you need to put them somewhere on your local machine to serve the files. There's two ways to do this. You can either go into IIS's settings and point it at a directory, or you can go to where IIS's default is. I'm going to do that just because it's a bit faster. I know it's in C, inetpub, www root. I have a folder called Playground where I do demos like this, so I'm going to go ahead and paste the demo folder in. It's now here. And now if I go back to my browser and I open a new tab, one, we'll go to localhost real quick to double check that IIS is loaded. And if it is, we get this lovely IIS message. And now if I go to Playground Demo, the samples will load. So that's it. So the samples are now loaded just like the instructions said. Now if we read here, it says, your three demo buddies enjoy their time with you so much they're going to give you their credentials. So we're going to make use of these credentials and actually log in. So how do we do that? It says access the files from a browser underneath localhost and the path to the samples, which I just did. And now it says click on the developer sandbox, which the instructions say, where are you signing in? We are in fact about to use the developer sandbox, so I'll say OK. I see it's asking for domain and token. If I go back, it says enter the domain gotuc.net without the quotes, so I'll go ahead and do that. Then it says to copy one of the OAuth tokens, yes, including the word bearer, into the token field. So I'll go ahead and just follow those instructions. Paste it in and double check. Yeah, bearer is there. Now it says click login. So go ahead and click login and see what happens. And after a couple seconds, we see we're logged in. Go ahead, you can see I can get my presence. I can go ahead and set it. And if I get it again, there it is. Start and stop would be the event channel, but we're not going to dive too much in the samples today, but you can see that we're logged in. Now, to really give you an idea of how quick this is and that it's not just Microsoft and IIS, I have ready to go here an Ubuntu Virtual Machine. So I'm going to show you guys how to do this real quick on Linux as well. And sorry if this isn't your favorite distro. The instructions should be pretty modifiable. So I'm already logged in. I'm already on the same page. I'm going to go ahead and download the USEWA helper libraries. They're downloading, and here we go. Go ahead and open the folder and extract them again. So I'm going to go ahead and extract them here. And I'm going to extract them into a folder again called Demo, just for consistency. Go ahead and extract. It says it's done. Sure enough, we see a folder called Demo. If you do not have web server installed on your Linux machine in those distros that use apt. You would just do sudo apt-get install Apache 2 or your favorite server. I'm just using Apache for now. Again, I already have it installed, so that command's not going to do anything. But if I didn't, that's what we want to do. So in Linux, under Apache, by default, it's in var www is where it's serving files from. So I'm going to copy, I'm going to go ahead and copy from downloads into that folder. So let's see where I'm going. Copy home, Alex, downloads, demo. Into this folder. Sure enough, there it is. If I go ahead and open a new tab here in Firefox and go to localhost, we see here it's giving us the index. It says the demo folder is in fact there, and if I click on it, the samples are here. Do the same thing now. Sam logging into the dev sandbox. Go ahead and copy a token. Type in got.uc. Paste in my token. Click login. You saw it here first, a Microsoft product running on Linux. There you go, the samples are running. Go ahead and do get presence again, show it's not a trick. Go ahead and do busy. Set my presence. Go ahead and double check. It really is working and it really is that simple. So, now I need to get out of here. There we are. So that's that. So now that we've discussed the samples for a bit, what I'd actually like to do is take a deep dive through these modules, these libraries that actually power the samples. And our intention here was to come up with the kinds of modules that we would expect developers need, or that we think most or all applications are going to require. The other intention here is, while we've only got JavaScript covered today, this API is usable from any language that has an HTTP stack. So there's no reason, you know, that you couldn't write apps in Python, in C#, in Ruby, in Visual Basic. As long as you can send and receive HTTP requests and responses, and if you have an XML or JSON library, which most languages do, you really can write UCY apps. It's nice. We get a lot of reach via this. And so by coming up with these modules, we wanted to inspire developers who are looking to move to other languages for the kinds of modules they may want to make. Obviously, you'll need to do some idiom translations into your language, but we think that at a higher level, which is the level I'm going to discuss these modules, we think that the breakdown is useful. So what I would suggest, if you have the samples open already, you've been following along, feel free to click through the modules. I'm not going to go in the exact order that they're listed, and I'm certainly not going to be reading them to you. I'm going to be talking from some notes that I have that kind of just describe our design philosophy for them. So the foundation of all of this would be the transport module. And here I'll click so you guys following along on my screen can see what I'm talking about. So to explain what's going on here, your app will likely not live on the link server because I doubt that your link server admin will let you. And it's quite possible that you're working as a third party and you'll be hosting your app on your own server and it'll be talking to your client's link server. So you can imagine your app living on app.com. Meanwhile, the link server is going to be living at link.company.com. So for security reasons, browsers prevent cross-domain requests from app.com to link.company.com. The reason that this is blocked is the following quick scenario. Imagine that you are logged into your bank in one tab, and you go to your favorite forum in another tab. Maybe you're a fan of cars and you're on a car forum. If browsers didn't block cross-domain requests, a nefarious member of the forum could put some JavaScript in their signature that runs when you load the page. And it could say, try going to mybank.com/transfer and do a post request with the two being my nefarious account and the amount being $1,000. And if cross-domain requests were allowed, when the post was issued by the JavaScript, it would be coming from your browser using whatever session and cookie data you have from the bank's site, and it would work. So we don't allow this. Our browsers in general do not allow this at all. If you want to see how the link server responds, if you try to do it from here, I have another machine set up called Houdini, which is not going to be on the allowed list of servers forgot you see. If I try and do anything in the developer sandbox, I'll go ahead and copy some credentials again. And I do gotuc.net and the token and click login. I get a message. This is actually passed by the server. We just have some code that bubbles it up to the UI that says, the service does not allow a cross-domain request from this origin. So how did the other samples work that weren't on Houdini? And the reason, the reason that they work is that the HTML5 family of standards has something called post message that allows us to securely circumvent this. It's a combination of this post message special kind of request, which is poorly named because it's not an HTTP post, and there's also an allowed list on the server side. For demo purposes and for playing around on gotuc, we've already added localhost for you. But once you graduate from doing quick demos on your own machine, you'll by then have access to some kind of demo topology. So what does transport do for you? All of that I just discussed, if you don't want to learn about it, you don't have to, because transport abstracts it all away. If you're trying to move to another language, though, you might need to understand it. It will also take care of adding your credentials to every request, since that's how we verify that you are who you say you are. For example, this would prevent me from sending an IM as Steve Ballmer, because it would know I'm me and not Steve Ballmer, and I would not be allowed to do that. So what can you as a developer do with it? The primary thing is that you can send requests and receive responses. And if we look down here in, I forget if it's the regular usage or the additional usage, you actually see an example, it is the additional usage, you'll see an example of us sending a request. So this is the simplest kind of request. It's got the URL that you want to send the request to, the type or the verb, and a callback method that you supply to handle the response. And the one we have here is pretty simple. It says, if it's a 200 or a 204, and anything in the 200 range is a success in HTTP, or we explicitly check for the success that comes back, like it says, it's probably a good idea to handle this request, and we'll say if the results are not undefined, if there's some data in there, then there's JSON data, and we should do something with it. And that's the simplest use case for it, but arguably the most powerful. If you go through the samples and read what each of them do, you'll see this used over and over. So the next module to discuss is the events module. And I mentioned the event channel before, so this is how you manage the event channel. The way the event channel works is that we use something called a pending get to push data down to applications without having to pull. A pending get is a standard but little used concept in HTTP. Here's the idea. A client, such as a web browser, issues a get. The server will then receive the get. Instead of replying right away, the server will simply wait. This is not actually a problem. The connection is left open. Nothing bad happens. We've done tests for battery life with mobile devices. It doesn't have an impact. And with the way HTTP is always done, it's always been it's typically implemented in an asynchronous way. The code is able to go ahead and do other things, so this doesn't lock your browser waiting for a pending get or prevent other requests from going out while the pending get is pending. Finally, when the server does have data it wants to send down, it will put the data into the response and finally release it, and the client will receive it. It's as if the request exited immediately, except we just held it for longer until we actually had data to send. Like I said, browsers and other HTTP stacks handle this very well, and it will allow events, allow apps to listen for events asynchronously. So what does this module do for you? Basically, once you have the event cycle or event pump started, upon receiving an event response, it will, in order, issue the next pending get request. That way, you're always ready to get new events. It will then parse the current pending get response, the one that you just received. And as it's parsing it, it will dispatch relevant event data to any listeners that you may have set up. So what can you do with it? Kind of just covered it. You can start that event channel, that event pump. You can stop it if you don't want to listen to events anymore. Typically, this means that you're probably shutting down your app, but you have other reasons. And then finally, you can register specific event listeners. For example, if your app does IM, you might want to set up a listener for incoming IMs, so that way when they come in, you can pop a toast or whatever UI you're using to say, you have an incoming IM from so-and-so. And again, just like in the other one, you can go ahead and look at some usage code. And you can see here We're setting up an event handler here. We're saying who's going to raise it. We're looking for /me/presence. And if we see a started or an updated event, we want us to call, or we want to call handle presence. Now we say to our events, we're going to add event handlers, and who's raising it we just specified, and what handlers we just specified above. Now we'll say start events, and that means anytime a me presence or a presence resource fires an event, if it's a started or an updated type, we'll get a handle presence will be called. And here it's just we see handle presence is simply an alert that alerts the results out. And after some time, if you call events stop events, the event pump will stop and you won't get any more events. And that's it. So next up is the cache. Hold on 1 second. And the cache is actually two slightly different types of caches mashed into one. We have what's called the event cache and the singleton cache. The event cache, the idea behind this is that in the event channel, we can sometimes send data in line. This is that embedding concept that we discussed before. Such data can be cached and used by your application, to indicate that an update has happened, and if the UI is there, you may want to update it. It's also possible to get an updated event, but not have any embedded data. To borrow terms from other caching mechanisms, we would say that you can now mark your cache as dirty. You know that the data you have is stale, and you may not have the new data yet. And like other caching mechanisms, the cost to refresh the data is such that we don't do it automatically. We rely on the app to go into the cache and say, this is dirty and I need it now, and actually go ahead and update. The other piece of the cache to discuss is the singleton cache. This one's pretty straightforward. There are certain things such as the application resource, the me resource, the people resource, the search resource that apps just need to know where they are. You don't want to lose track of them. So we have the singleton cache just as a convenience to hang on to these important resources for you. So what does it do for you? It listens on the event channel and updates the cache, and updates the event piece of the cache. And it will also listen on the command channel and update the singleton cache. And what can you do with it? You actually have the option to read directly from the cache, write directly to the cache. And then we have some convenience methods on top of this read and write that help with the singleton cache. So you can, give the name of the application resource and get back a link or its body, or you can do the same thing and say, within the application resource, I know me is embedded. Can you give me its link? And it will take care of that for you. And again, if we look down in, if we look down here in the code snippet, we'll see some usage. So we see that we're caching some links. We're looking for the self link. We're looking for self embedded in presence. Here's some sample event data, and we see it getting written to and read from that cache. And it's a look after looking at this, it helps to go look at one of the actual sample tasks to see how these things are used. Next one to discuss is auto discovery. So unlike other web APIs where there's a single entry point, typically api.company.com, Link has something unique where there can be multiple servers within a pool, or even you could have something called a hybrid deployment where some of your servers are on-prem server that your company owns and other pieces of it are actually hosted online. However, despite all this, each user has a home server, and so once you've logged in, the USIWA instance on your home server is the one that will serve you. So auto-discovery helps you find your home server. So what the module does for you is it starts the auto-discovery process and calls into the authentication module as necessary, and it will also take care of testing the cross-domain frame that's loaded during this process. So as you move from server to server, the URL may change, and link.company.com is different from linkserver1.company.com. So each time we make the jump, we have to change the cross-domain frame that's being used by transport underneath. And again, if your eyes kind of glazed over while I was describing that whole cross-domain thing, just know that this module helps out with that. So it's pretty simple. The only thing that you can actually do with it is start the auto-discovery process. It will take care of everything under the hood for you. You can see there's just that start discovery method that we call here in the sample. The next thing, I tried not to do as much as I could, but auto-discovery and authentication are very closely linked, so I had to mention it before I fully discussed it. So now we'll discuss authentication. Basic idea here is that credentials, such as a username and password, are exchanged for an OAuth token that will then be sent with every request. That was the credentials I mentioned back in the credentials that I mentioned back at Transport. So what does this module do for you? It follows the links and challenges that occur between auto discovery and authentication. It will exchange credentials that you provide to it for the OAuth token, and in this case, it'll actually go ahead and create the application for you, since we assume that's your logical next step. What can you do with it? You can start that authentication process, and you can provide the credentials to be exchanged for an OAuth token. So in the samples, when you type in the credentials and click login, one of the things we do is we take the authentication module and actually pass it the credentials so it can make use of them. And if we go look at the usage, we'll see here, here's authentication working in tandem with discovery. You see that they're both mentioned in the usage together. And you'll see once discovery is done and hands off to authentication, it sets the credentials to a username and password, and it goes ahead and starts up. And once it's done, you're logged in and you can begin using the rest of your application. So the next thing we're going to discuss is operation resource. Now, a quick detour to explain exactly what an operation resource is. Some actions in USIWA take long enough that they can't be completed synchronously. The things we've discussed so far don't really fall in that category, like trying to do a get on someone's presence. Typically, we can get the presence quickly enough that we'll return it in a synchronous fashion. For those things that take longer, USIWA allows you to create or start the process on the command channel and receive updates about it on the event channel. A really good example of this was that phone call piece of the demo that Firmary was showing earlier. You can imagine that it takes some time for us to set up the call. It takes some time for the call to ring. It takes some time for the person to pick up. It takes some time for the server to register it and actually start piping the audio to you. Because that takes enough time that it doesn't make sense to cover it in one round trip, we say that you actually will create an operation resource called a phone audio invitation that tracks the progress of this until it's either succeeded and you're in an audio conversation with someone, or it's failed and we let you know that they didn't pick up or it was forwarded to voicemail or whatever happened. These long-running tasks, as I just said, are captured as something called an operation resource. So what does this module do for you? It takes care of the mandatory steps that you need for creating an operation resource, and it's actually a really thin wrapper on top of Transport and on top of the event channel. So in order, it creates an operation ID. This is a unique number, or I guess it's alphanumeric. It's a unique string of some kind that you can use to track the operation resource on the event channel. In this case, we use a GUID. The second thing it does is it registers the handlers with the event module for the operation ID that we just created, so that way you can keep track of it. And finally, it issues a request on the command channel to actually go ahead and create the operation resource. And that way, you have your unique identifier, you're already listening for it in the event channel, and then you finally issue the command channel request that creates it. And so what you can do with it, one thing, but one important thing, is actually go ahead and create a well-formed operation resource. If we go ahead and look at usage, we'll see that's exactly what's going on. We have a request. We say here at start messaging, it's going to be a post. We have some IM data that we're trying to send. And then we have our handlers. We say if it's started, say it's started. Once it's completed, say it's completed. And we say start the operation. What request are we trying to make? And what handlers are we trying to use? And if you look at the request and handlers, they actually look a lot like the request and handlers that we saw in Transport and in events, respectively. We're almost done. Next thing to discuss is batch. So for various reasons, applications may need to limit the number of outstanding requests. For example, some browsers have a limit of 6 or 8 outstanding requests at a time per page or per tab. Other stacks may have other limitations. So batch allows you to package multiple HTTP requests in a single request. So let's say that you need to get the contact information for 10 people you were displaying in a buddy list. Instead of having to do 10 requests and possibly filling up your total number of requests that you can do, you could issue a single batch that contains within it the 10 gets on 10 contacts, and it will come back to you as one response that actually contains 10 responses as if you had set the 10 separately. So what does the batching module do for you? Two things. One, it queues up requests for you, and it will release the queue after a timer elapses or the queue fills up. So what can you do with it as a developer? You can build a badge request by enqueuing individual requests, or you can send a batch request manually regardless of the timer or the queue size. So if you know that you need to fire off these 10 quickly, you can load up all 10 rapid fire and say release the batch right now, and it'll go ahead and execute for you. So if we go look at the usage, you'll see this happening here. So we queue up a request here for my link and for my link 2. One's a get, one's a post, and they have slightly different callbacks and everything. And as you call queue requests, it's enqueuing them, and you notice that the format looks a whole lot like the one for transport. That's fully intentional. And then you can either call process batch or wait out the timer limit, which by default is 3 seconds. And that's how batch works. The last thing to discuss, and this one we're going to discuss real quickly, is MIME. MIME only exists because batch requests and responses are packaged up as MIME parts. And there's no elegant in-browser solution, or at least not one that's portable across browsers, that can handle the MIME formatting. So we create a library that takes care of packaging up and unpackaging MIME for you. So really the only use that you would have for it is to parse the multi-part responses into an array of individual response objects that look like the ones that came back from transport. You can just, the only method it's got is to actually go ahead and parse a response. So we have a sample, and you see it looks kind of messy and long. And then if we go ahead and call process message on it, we'll get back a results thing, which is an array which contains each of these responses properly parsed. This is used implicitly already by the batching module, so you don't really have to use it explicitly, but we have it here because it's a sizable piece of code and it works pretty well. And that's it for the modules. Oh, yeah. Kai's not mic'd up at the moment, but even though we are running long, we do promise we will be sticking around for questions. So if you guys can, we've also been getting your questions so far.
All right. As I mentioned earlier, we at Microsoft believe that this API is very powerful, and we want to make this available to you guys to enable developers to connect people in new and exciting ways. In this particular demo, it was put together internally just to give you guys an idea of what's possible. This is a Windows 8 slate, so imagine the scenario. A taxi company wanted to enhance the entire experience of calling a cab. So what they do is they build a Windows 8 application, and they use Slink as the backbone to power the communications for that app. So a taxi driver would have this slate mounted in their dashboard, so the app would constantly be open, and the taxi driver can decide that he wants to take a break, in which case when he does that, then you can see his status changes to away, and if a customer were to request a taxi at this time, then it would just be routed to a different driver who's happened to be available. So this driver say that he's now able to take new clients. So what would happen from the client perspective? So imagine from the end user or customer perspective, they would have a mobile device like a Windows phone or a mobile device of choice. What they would do is they would go to the website of that particular company. And I've already put my credentials. You do not need a Microsoft account to use this API. It's just that we chose to use a Microsoft account in this case just to know your person's name and their location. All right, so here I am in Redmond, Washington. I would like to go to Seattle Airport. And from a driver's perspective, he can see that a customer has been found. They want to go to Seattle Airport. Do you want to confirm pickup? A driver, if they say yes, I want to confirm, then his status has changed to busy. Any calls now would be routed to a different driver.
Yes, pick me up. So this is the view of the customer. I said, "Yes, please pick me up. Here's my driver, Ike Chen, taxi number 2547, and he will arrive in a few minutes." Oh, I didn't realize it was going to be that soon. So I want to send him a note when you arrive. Tell me when you arrive. So from the driver's point of view, of course, the driver doesn't want to write while they're driving, so we have preset messages. Oh, I'm here. So send that as a reply. The end user would see that the driver's there. And I would write something like, okay. So you can see instant communication, real-time communication between the driver and the end user, enhancing that entire user experience. And once the taxi has completed that particular ride, then he can set himself to available, in which case other calls would be routed to this driver again. So that is our demo. So now we're going to see a real application built by someone just like you. Like I mentioned in the introduction, we have James Jones, who is here to show us how he leveraged the web API with Sociable Now, an app that he's going to be showcasing for us today. James?
I am James Jones, CEO of Telex Networks, and I'm here to show you kind of our demo integration that we've done with the Link web-based API. And just so you know a little bit more about what Sociable Now is, Sociable Now is a platform that allows you to create a link or QR code that allows you to, if you click on the short link that it generates, it will actually open up a website in your web browser and turn your browser into a telephone and call a predetermined number. Or if you scan the QR code, it will actually open up your phone's dialer and make a phone call. And the cool thing about that since it's a web-based transaction that happens in the background with that, it actually allows you to gain web-based analytics of voice conversations and telephone calls through that process. And what we've done with the Link integration is actually kind of enabled our dialer to work with Link in regards to doing a quick social media integration using Facebook and kind of using Facebook as a CRM tool in this particular instance. But you can use any sort of a CRM tool or whatever you want. But the whole idea about Social Now is actually kind of merging voice over IP with social media. And we've been able to achieve that with Sociable Now. And so we'll go ahead and show you what we've done with the Link client here, and just make sure this is all set up, because I've also, you can see my phone here when the call comes in, and I've also already logged into Link with the Link client. And as you can see, some emails coming in on my phone. So what we have here, let me go ahead and log into Link. Using the web-based API tool. Hopefully I remembered my password. Yes. And so what will happen now is when I click on the Sociable Now task, because I've added a new task to the samples to kind of do this prototype integration, it should ask me to log into Facebook, which it is. And you guys feel free to friend me. This is actually a way really old email address when I was living in New Zealand, but go ahead and log in here. Whoops, wrong password. Here we go. And now what's happened, it's actually went and got all the online contacts from Link that are assigned to this user. And now it's going to make a phone call. It basically got all the online contacts, picked one at random, and then now it's calling. So I'll answer this call. And now we have a call established using this a flash-based dialer, which goes off to a media server. And I'll show you when I show you the slide deck, you know, about the architecture. But it's a quick way of doing a call queue via a website using the power of Link. And it was, you know, a interesting implementation. And if we go back and look, now what happened, the user who got selected for the call actually got pushed information from the Facebook API calls that were done on the backside. So now with this particular user, I know it's a verified Facebook user. I know that the person's name, gender, their profile page, their username, their hometown, and their location. Now, all this stuff has been pre-selected, and it's just kind of to show what the potential possibilities are. But you could do integration with Salesforce and all these other different types of CRM or social media sites. You could do this with Twitter, anywhere else. And it's kind of just merging the unified communications world with social media or any other web-based type of content systems. So it's a very good way, I think, of showing what potential Link has in regards to unifying communications that much further and kind of bringing all these different worlds together.
Thank you, James. That is a phenomenal way to leverage the web API, and thank you for taking time to share that up with us. We are coming to an end of this session, and as promised, we do have some time for Q&A, but before we jump into that, I want to take a second to thank all of you for joining us today. As I mentioned before, we at Microsoft believe that this technology is a giant leap forward, and our goal is to empower you guys and girls with this API so that you leverage our platform to create groundbreaking apps as you continue to connect people in new and exciting ways. We hope that you liked what you saw and that you are compelled to check out the API on your own. We really do look forward to seeing what kind of applications you guys are going to build. So with that, let us go to Q&A. Alex, do you want to go ahead and share your docs so that we see the questions that our folks posted today?
So, first thing I see up there is, when will the audio and video call, or when will the audio and video call feature be available? My first reaction is not it. The answer would be that we do not discuss. We don't have anything specific to discuss in our roadmap. If you watch the previous presentation, we do say that it's something we're considering for the future. But the fact that you've said it is a vote for it. And that helps us in our planning to know what's more important. to give you a funny story about it, I was sitting at a smaller developer event we had about a year ago, and two guys were like, yeah, where are the other modalities? And I said, well, could you prioritize them for me? And they work for the same company, and one says audio-video, and the other says screen sharing. And then they got into an argument. And I said, well, once you two settle on which one you think is more important, let me know, and that'll help us with our stack ranking. The next question here I see is, without a utility API for the event channel, we actually have to pull the event channel each time with a different link. Did you consider SignalR or some similar framework for implementation of UCY event handling? So that is true. It's a slightly different link, however, it's everything in UCY. You're supposed to follow the links that you're given. So the fact that the event channel tells you what to do next is a virtue of the event channel and a virtue of our design. So I don't really consider that a problem per se. I'm not sure if that's what you're implying there, but yes, technically the link is different, but you're supposed to follow. SignalR is certainly interesting, and there's nothing in our design that prevents us from using it, but given that UCY has been in design for nearly 3 years, SignalR wasn't mature enough when we really started to commit to building this to use it, but it's certainly something that we're interested in and we've looked at. But right now, there's no SignalR. Next question here. Yeah, I see a question that you didn't copy. I think someone was asking, will ucy.link.com/documentation get updates to improve it as time goes on? And the answer is absolutely. We've already added several articles and fixed quite a few typos. If you have any specific feedback, if there's something that you noticed, please let us know. We figured it would be better to start with the essentials and add as necessary, because we don't want people overwhelmed with documentation they can't find answers. If someone asks a question and it was in there, then I would say we probably got too much and need to reorganize it or trim it down. Next one there. Will the sandbox be getting preloaded with some context for the three test users in the near future? Without having context, you can't test out a lot of the samples. Yes. That was not our intention. We learned about this glitch that some of the users don't have context, and we're working to fix it. If you hit a specific user pair, do we want to know about specifics, or are we just going to try to fix them in bulk? I guess it's something we'll have to take offline and discuss.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But it is a known issue, and we're working to fix it. I know that I hope some of them do. I hope that if you've done it a few times, at least a few of them have had, because they're supposed to. But a few of them seem to have gotten missed when we did the pairing. So is USIWA, as it is today, supposed to be, or will it be modified at all in this version? Is it RTM? So the version of USIWA that ships with Link Server CU1, the one that you're touching when you use GotUC, that is RTM for USIWA. So that, as it is not changing. That is V1. That is RTM. Obviously, we hope to update it. We hope to expand on functionality, but you're no longer in a beta. This is it. It's released. Hopefully that answers the question. Okay. Are there any plans to allow developers, users, to manage, add, or remove contacts? This doesn't appear to be supported with the current version of USIWA. So, correct. The first version of USIWA doesn't support contacts. As for your question about future plans, see my previous answer. But again, the fact that you mentioned, the important part is the fact that you spoke up that it's something that you want is a plus one for us as we plan and try to rank these different things. So now I can pit you two against each other and say, what's more important, audio, video, or contact management? All right. So next thing, is there a use at your own risk attitude for developers using the helper libraries? Absolutely not. I would say think of it like the Facebook PHP libraries. Facebook does provide them. Bug reports are encouraged. But they're not actually the API. The thing that the libraries are talking to is the API. And it's possible that in one browser version somewhere, something could go wrong where we could have an issue. But if you go ahead and open up curl or something that does pure HTTP requests and responses, things are working. Those are the kinds of things that, just given the diverse set of browsers, the diverse set of HTTP stacks and configurations, there's a lot of ground to cover. But I would certainly not say it's use at your own risk. As you can see, James had a lot of success using it, and James was in our tap and using it with changes going on each time. By the way, awesome job, James. It looks like you upgraded from our last drop to the final RTM drop. Nice job. So it's really not a use at your own risk attitude at all.
There's a follow-up question, which is, will there be updates to the helper libraries?
So... will there be updates to the helper libraries? Absolutely. And actually, I think there was a question about something about that where I did mention, or an upcoming question where I kind of jotted that down in my notes. But yes, we do. We are hoping to get another set, another dropout with some updates. We've noticed some minor glitches that we want to fix, a couple little things we want to add. So yes, absolutely. Okay, so the next thing. Is there a concept... yeah, like UCMA's Trusted Application Endpoint, which can impersonate any user. Thank you for defining the term for me. So for people who aren't familiar with USIWA, this is instead of you logging in as a user, you're in God mode effectively. You can be anyone. USIWA is focused on user-centric endpoints today, so no, there's nothing like UCMA's Trusted Endpoint concept in USIWA. Where and who can we report issues to with the helper libraries? I would say for now post on the forums. We don't have a formal process in place yet. We're still getting used to this. But yeah, I would say...
the forums are formal because we monitor them. So.
Guy's correcting me. The forums are monitored carefully and consider that our formal process. I guess I meant we don't have like a bug tracker for them that right. External people can file bugs on. I guess that's what I meant. But consider the forums your main point of contact with us. They're monitored all the time. Is there a way to do virtual room like a traditional MCU but in Link? A link that I can post on a portal and connect automatically to an MCU. So It sounds like you're describing several things. This question was posed by who? By, and pardon my pronunciation, I messed up. It seems it's Hans Padilla. I'm not 100% sure I follow. Hans, I'm going to go ahead and unmute you. Can you kind of explain it just from a scenario perspective, just to be sure I understand? It sounds almost like you're describing like anonymous chat. I've just unmuted you. Hopefully you have a mic. It sounds like you're describing kind of an anonymous like click to chat link. Is that what you're describing? I unmuted you, but feel free to type. Hans? Okay, well, I'll leave you unmuted in case you come back. Anyway, so my understanding is this sounds like kind of an anonymous click to chat where, you know, you have like a contact, you know, contact me as an individual at my company, regardless of whether or not you have credentials. So it's not just a magic link that you can post on the portal, but with a little bit of work using the anonymous chat flow that's discussed in the documentation, website, you could make this scenario work. Okay. Is that different from long polling? I believe long polling is another name for pending get. This is, we don't like to use that one because it implies that it's just repeated polling, but the event channel kind of has a lot more granularity than that. You know, we have some logical things. For example, an incoming IM or an incoming call is given the highest priority and we'll release it immediately. But if you're getting lower priority things, such as, you know, a contact's note got updated, we won't flood you with those. We found in our testing that, you know, in scenarios where you're kind of sitting idle, you can easily sit for up to 15 minutes not receiving any responses in the event channel. So you end up doing, call it four an hour. And for a mobile device where you're concerned about battery, dealing with only four HTTP responses in an hour is pretty lightweight. Now, obviously, that's the idle case. When you're doing an IM conversation, it goes up. But, yeah, so because it's pretty because it can be pretty low, it's not as rapid as polling, we try to stay away from the name. But I do believe that's correct. It's next one. How you stop listening to specific events rather than stopping them all? The samples seem to just add events or stop all events. Yes, that's correct. It's something that we're considering for the next drop. We figure that in most scenarios, you'll kind of hang on to your handlers and things will keep going. Certainly, there's scenarios where that's not the case. But for the initial drop, we figured it was good enough to have it the way it was, because having a spare handler lying around that, you know, for an event that only shows up once is, it's a bit of a memory problem, maybe. But other than that, it's not really going to cause too much trouble. So which methodology did you use to build the event utility? Long polling, service and events, forever frame. I believe we covered that it would be long polling, but again, we like to call it pending get because the polling thing sounds bad, and it's really not that bad, we promise. We've done study. We have various apps built on it. We've seen that it does work pretty well. So next thing, in the samples, you don't pass the full credentials through, do you? Password seems to be for nothing, just the domain is used from start to finish. So it depends on the flow. There's several different flows that can be used, and they're discussed on the documentation site here. I'll am the link to everyone.
Read it out too.
Yeah. So it's it's not short.
It's on ucwa.link.com.
If you go to the documentation page and you click on getting started, there's an authentication topic that discusses it. That would be the quick way to get to it. So looking at that, password is used. It just depends on the flow you're using. If you're pasting the domain and the web ticket, obviously we're not needing a password at all. If you just type in a username and your topology supports it, we'll pop up the integrated Windows auth, where it's actually a Windows OS-based prompt that asks you for your username and password. Very much depends on the flow. So next question, could it be a sample that shows how the OAuth token would be retrieved fully? So yes, if you say that you're using my own topology instead of gotuc, you can pass the username and password and that would be fully retrieved. So that takes care of part A, which is asking if there's a way than rather having the token up front. And part B says, rather than using Windows auth to log in the enterprise. So if you use the username and password flow, which is distinct from Windows auth, you're not using Windows auth, like I said, there's multiple different flows that you can use. It just depends on what's supported in the link topology you're talking to. Are there follow-up questions coming in? Let's see. Okay, cool. In the enterprise, what are the support auth mechanisms? Are all browsers supported when not using a pre-specified auth token? Check that docs page I just specified. It lists everything that Link server supports. Keep in mind that this can then be set up by the admin. If the admin really doesn't like Windows auth for some reason, they can turn it off, and then you can't use it. But all the supported types are discussed, you know, in an ideal world if everything were turned on. Okay, can we scroll down?
Yes.
Thanks. Hold on. Okay, so now batch. Would you recommend always using batch since it's going to make requests more efficient? Well, it's going to batch them up. So it very much depends on what you're doing. Kind of like you say, it's hard to know if you should batch or just fire. It depends on what the user is doing. Yes, I think you're sort of starting to answer the question there. Batching has the advantage of saving, you know, if you only have a limited number of outstanding HTTP requests you can have at a time, batching will obviously effectively multiplex that and let you have more than the ones that you're allowed to have. The downside would be that there's now a delay because you won't get a response back from batch until all of them complete. So there's a trade-off there. I would say if it's a user-initiated action, I would probably not batch it. But if you're doing things like when the user switches to, you know, the contact list view or expands a group and you need to get the presence of group members you didn't have before, I might batch those up. But it very much depends on what your application is doing, what's going on. I wouldn't say that there's a hard and fast rule of always use batch or never use batch or use batch only here. That expanding a group thing just came to the top. It came to my head now while thinking about it. It would just very much depend on your scenario. So is USEWA available on Office 365? Not at the moment.
So they're asking why not Office 365 today? just haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, it takes time to get things into the service. Haven't gotten to it. Wish I had a more specific answer. But obviously it's something that we would like to see. Are any of us going to be at WPC 2013?
Albert Koyman is going to be there, and we'll definitely let people know who else from the team is going to join.
Yeah, maybe that's something we can put on the forum. We'll see who's going. For people who don't know who Albert is, can we give them like a 10-second?
Yes, absolutely. Albert is our senior product marketing manager, and he's in charge of the platform, marketing the platform, and he will be in the World Partner Conference 2013.
But simply, he's the one who, along with Firmary, will help gather your questions about roadmap and what you have the most business, or what drives the most value for you, and help us make help us with our stack ranking.
Okay, so shall we wrap things up?
This would be the end of the presentation if we don't have any further questions. Thank you again for joining us, and we truly look forward to see the applications that you guys are building with this API. Thank you once again, and until the next developer roundtable, good luck. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, everyone. Thank you. And a round of applause to James for coming and demoing for us, by the way. Thanks so much.
Yep, no problem. Anytime.